Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey, listeners, Kevin and I need your help.
Yes, we need your help. Please, please, please. We need your stars. We need your reviews, you guys, on iTunes so we can start to climb those iTunes rating charts.
It's simple. Open iTunes, click on the iTunes store, search for Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
Then click on Ratings and Reviews. Under the Customer Reviews, click Write a Review. Then let us know what you think from 1 to 5 stars.
If you need some help, think of 1 star being Carol Channing and Paul Lynn in the Road Company of the last 5 years, and 5 stars being free front row tickets to Hamilton. Although, when you think about it, I actually would give 5 stars to the Road Company of Carol Channing and Paul Lynn in the last 5 years, because I think that would be awesome.
I would love to hear, can I hear Moving Too Fast as Paul? that's the one I really want.
She's a Shakespeare goddess. Been through Erica Schwartz and Danica Weiss and the Handelman twins.
So there you go. You can also leave a comment if you like.
That's it. That's
your reviews.
It.
Send us your reviews, friends.
Please. Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Broadway Curtain and on Instagram at Broadway Curtain Podcast.
And make sure to join our Facebook page at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. We are also excited to announce that you can listen to us on the Broadway radio.
Ooh. Today's living legend is the reason many of us fell in love with Broadway. Originating one of the most iconic roles in musical theater, our guest's voice first gave life to such songs as I Feel Pretty, Tonight, and Somewhere.
Yeah, but originating the role of Maria in West Side Story is only one of this great lady's many accomplishments. She was also in 11 other Broadway shows, including I Do, I Do, Kiss of the Spider-Woman, Saratoga, which is actually one of my favorites, and it is Plain and Fancy. Plus, she's the author of 2 books, including Carol Lawrence, The Backstage Story, and I Remember Pasta, A Celebration of Food, Family, and Friends.
I love that title, I Remember Pasta.
I Remember Pasta.
To tell us what it was like to work with such legends as Leonard Bernstein, Jerome Robbins, and Paul Lynn, here is the former Carolina Maria Laria, or better known to us as Tony nominee, Carol Lawrence. Hi, Carol. This is Rob Schneider from Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. How are you today?
I'm terrific. How are you doing?
Good. I wanted to introduce you to my co-host, Kevin David Thomas.
Hello there, Carol. How are you today?
Couldn't be better, Kevin.
So our first question is how did a girl from Melrose Park fall in love with musical theater?
Well, it wasn't musical theater because I was in a little hometown called Melrose Park, Illinois, which is about 20 miles due west of Chicago, and excuse me, I've got a little frog in my throat, but unless you were downtown at the Chicago Opera House or you were at the Chicago Theater, which took an hour pretty much to get to, one did not see theater. So my musical theater expose was really movies, and my mother was an avid moviegoer, and she loved to sing and dance. She should have been in the business, but her father was exceedingly Italian, old world, could neither read nor write, and he had 6 daughters, and the idea of one of them wanting to be in show business was not allowed. He kept saying, no, you'll just be a Bhutan. and that's a hooker, you know that. With that kind of faith in your talents, one does not get to go into show business. So my mother was a bit of, I guess, really interested in being in show business, but totally forbidden. So when I came out singing and dancing and running and jumping, and she told me that when I was just a baby in my crib, as soon as I could lift myself to the rung that you hold on to, and there was music playing in the house, I was dancing. Well, I was jumping up and down, you know, to the music. And for her, that was good enough. So I do believe that my mother encouraged me, as any Italian mother does, for whatever the child is doing. That was a given. She was my cheerleading section, and I truly owe my love of music and dance to her.
Did they sing in the household, or did you hear a lot of music, even Italian music or opera or anything like that, while you were growing up with them? No.
Parents were very, very poor. My father was born in Italy in a little town called Trevigno, Three Vines, and it is very, very, well, it's 17 miles from Potenza, which is the capital of Basilicata, and that is the poorest province in all of Italy. It sits around the ankle bone. If you look at your left foot as Italy, right where your ankle bone is the highest is where my father was born, in the mountains of a very medieval little town called Three Vines, Trevigno. I went back to see it, and it's as poor as it gets, but as magnificently beautiful as a postcard. I grew up in a tremendously Catholic, old-world, protected atmosphere of church and holidays and rules and nuns and rulers and punishment. The reason Italians and Jews are such good friends is that they are absolutely the same people. It's exactly the same format. And all that, oy vey mio, what did you do to me? God bless you, God bless. And it's, but it's in Italian. And I always say being born into an Italian family is like living at dress rehearsal for the Metropolitan Opera. Everybody it's true. Everybody is hell-bent on getting that curtain up no matter what you've done. And whether you have to kill somebody to make it happen, it's part of the game. And it's all excusable. It's all forgivable. And it's done every day. So, and what the best part of it, Rob, is that once you have said to somebody, I don't want you ever to say that to me again. Is that clear? And they say, oh, okay, I didn't know it was going to bother you that much, but okay, I won't say it anymore. And it's over. It is over. Yeah. It's now kissing and loving and hugging and feeding. They love to feed you. That's how Italians say, I love you and thank you, and I'm really sorry I hit you so hard. It's just, that's what happened. And that's what I grew up in and with, and my family, my immediate family was very small because my father was so hell-bent on giving me the education he never got. When I won a scholarship, my father happened to be raised by a very sad, I guess abused child, and I don't know what his father did because nobody has any records. The little town in which my father was born, Trevigno, had not a school, a hospital, a doctor, a nurse. Nothing but the square where the church was, the city hall, and where all the feasts, you know, Festa Madonna, Festa San Giuseppe, all of those things happened around the church and happened musically and festively, and tons of food, and who was going to outdo the ravioli recipe of Mrs. Scarciofi. And my mother was maybe the best cook I've ever known in my life. I've written a book of her recipes that she gave to nobody but me complete, and I call it I Remember Pasta. because my mother was just about the best. Well, but every Italian person thinks their mother is the best.
It's true.
It is true. And it's probably a given. And I don't fight it at all. I was always allowed by my grandmother to do whatever made me the happiest or whatever would make people laugh or make the party more fun. That's what she was about. And I think that's what theater is. It's telling a story and making it understood and felt and a lesson for tomorrow. I think that's what Socrates wanted it to be. He always said, you enter the theater in one condition and leave it better off.
Yeah.
You should have learned something. And so I think that's what West Side Story was trying to do. I think that's what Hamilton is still doing it. And you saw the Tonys last night, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, we did.
Weren't they wonderful?
Oh. We thought they were fantastic. We thought they were absolutely fantastic.
One it was like a throwback.
Yes,
pardon?
It was. I said it was one of the best Tony performances I've seen in years. I think that it was like a throwback, like you were saying.
Shall I tell you why it was exactly that? It was an old-fashioned theatrical live theater, not with so many gimmicks, not with people running in from the audience and hopping all the way down. I mean, Hugh Jackson is a fabulous human being, but, you know, if you can't do a dance number, you just have to hop through the whole thing in order to get attention. There's something wrong with you, or you're a rabbit. I don't know what it is.
I remember that, yeah.
We thought last night was beautiful, and we thought it was really touching. When they brought on all the young children at the beginning and said, you know, this could be your future, this could be you in a few years, we thought that was really, really moving. And so I have to ask you, you know, you said that your mother was your greatest asset. Was she the one who took? Was she the one who took you to dance classes?
Absolutely. You know that I came from a very small town, Melrose Park, Illinois. Maybe had 20,000 people in the whole city, and it was about 20-25 miles due west of Chicago, of the Loop, of downtown, of Lake Michigan, and when you went into the city, it was an event. You went in to see a show, or you went, you know, I eventually began studying there. But my first lessons were in a local studio, like every other little kid that you've ever known. And we were looking at movies of Shirley Temple and Ginger Rogers and Gene Kelly. Tap dancing was a big deal. Today, not so much. And if you were ever to audition for West Side Story, you never said you could tap dance because Jerry Robbins hated hoofers. He just hated them. And I don't know why, because I think some of the greatest dancers in the world were tap dancers. Fred Astaire, Ginger, Eleanor Powell, Gene Kelly, all the began rhythmically. And so that's how I began learning to dance. My mother put those little patent leather shoes on. Only she was so theatrical. Everybody else had black satin ribbons, you know, and across the instep. Mine were red satin. I don't know why they were red satin, except that my mother said black was uninteresting.
Made you stand out.
That's right, Mom.
Got it. You got it.
Did you, oh, yeah.
So I walked out on that floor, and the teacher said, shuffle, hop, flap, whatever it was, we were looking at the mirror, never saw that before, and making noise just like Shirley Temple. And I thought, my goodness, I'm already a tap dancer. And I was so thrilled. I went home, walked directly to the kitchen, where I knew there was linoleum, and I could make noise. And so I started doing it. And my mother looked down, and she said, oh, my, stop. Okay, that's enough. Because I was making black marks on my mother's immaculate linoleum floor. And that is not allowed in any Italian household. So my mother said, whoa, that's not going to work. You're going to practice, we know that. But I'm going to pull the stove away from the wall just a little, and you're going to go behind the stove, and you're going to practice to your heart's content. As long as you want, you can do it. So I had 2 feet square behind the stove, and I literally wore away the linoleum pattern to the black asbestos, and I wore out the name of the taps on my little steel front of the taps, you know, of the shoe.
Yeah.
And it used to say Max Taps, and now it says Max Taps. And I still have them because my mother saved them.
Oh, wow, that's special.
Bless your mother.
And the next act that I will do at 83 is going to be called From Behind the Stove. Because people always ask, well, where did you get started? I said, well, from behind the stove. I came out. And by that time, I was tap dancing because my mother gave me all the time I wanted. She always came in and listened and said, oh, that sounds good. That's better now. That's wonderful. And she encouraged me, and she'd try to do it with me. I'd say, that's not quite the way you do it, Ma, but it's all right. Keep trying.
Right?
Did you have to lie about your age in order to get a work permit when you were...
of course. I was only 13 when I had my own nightclub act.
What?
And we said I was 16. Well, by that time, you see, I had gone to the local studio. It was called Georgine Ray, R-A-E. And nice. She was a tap dancer, and she tapped at the Chicago Theater. That's how good she was. She was a professional tap dancer. But she didn't do ballet. I mean, she did a little ballet, and she taught me a little ballet, but it wasn't great. Her forte was tap dancing, and she gave me an incredible basic knowledge of really difficult tap steps, because she was a professional. That's how she earned her living, was at the Chicago Theater. And she taught in Maywood, Illinois, which was the next little town next to Melrose Park, Illinois. Then there was Elmwood. Then there was Elmhurst. Then there was Oak Park. Then there was, I mean, it goes on like that until you get to Chicago. And you take a train, and then it becomes an elevated, and it goes around the loop, and then it turns around and comes back home again. But my mother always drove me to the local dance studio because I was 5 when I began. Excuse me. And I stayed there till I was about 9. Mm. And then she decided, my mother, having done some research, she was always looking for the better place for me to learn how to do whatever it was. And she found a ballet teacher who taught toe dancing, you know, in these beautiful pink slippers. And so I would be going for tap class at like 9 o'clock in the morning, and then I would go at 11 o'clock to my toe class with Dorothy D. Houghton. And so I was always in 2 recitals. I got to do my tap solo, and then I got to do the ballet. But they seldom, you see, at that time, ballet dancers didn't know tap dancing. It was 2 camps that were very, very competitive. And so if you were a tap dancer, didn't mean that you were a great toe dancer, and vice versa. You could always tell a ballet dancer when they would try to be tapped because their feet would turn out.
Carol, how did you get from Illinois to New York City then?
Okay, I was... in all these recitals, and then my mother heard or read or saw something in the Tribune about Edna McCrae's School of the Dance. Who ever heard of that? And so she found out that they did scholarships, because my father did not want me to be in the business. He was very much like my mother's father, who said, you know, you're just going to be a hooker at the end of this whole thing, so I'm not going to allow you to do that. My father would not contribute a penny towards my dancing, except at a local, you know, everybody in Melrose Park took that tap dancing. There was nothing wrong with that. But when you wanted to go downtown on Michigan Avenue in Chicago in the Loop, that's an hour's travel before you even get to class. So now I was about 11. No, I was 11. And I went to compete, and I didn't make the first. No, I did make the first. Excuse me. I competed in tap, and I won the tap scholarship, which put me in with the professional students. But I did not qualify in ballet. So I was in a beginner's ballet class at the Edna McCrae School of the Dance. And I was in the professional with all the grown-up 40-year-olds who were dancing at the Chicago Theater.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, that's how good a tap dancer. I am basically a hoofer. Never tell Jerry Robbins, because I could never get the part of Maria. Never! And the point is that I would be in the professional tap class, and Edna McCrae would hire those professionals to teach me the tap routine. And then I would write it out and teach it to her so that she could teach the next group of tap dancers coming in.
Wow.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So put me in a very strange position with her, because I was her teacher in tap, and she was my disciplinarian Hitler in ballet class. I mean, she taught with a cane in her hand. She hit you when you didn't do it right.
Oh, my.
So she was old Russian school, and pretty much what ballet choreographers are. That's what Jerry Robbins was when he directed West Side Story. He didn't know how to direct. He had never acted in his life. He did not know that telling a person they are the stupidest idiot that ever lived, put your hands in your pockets, you don't know how to use them. Larry Kurt, in the first 6 months of West Side, never took his hands out of his pockets unless they were around me.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's sad. That's really not acceptable today. He would never get away with what he did to us in West Side.
Yeah, and I wonder if it, because, you know, usually with theater, when you're rehearsing, you want to have a nice, healthy rehearsal room. You want everyone to feel a little positive so they can get their best work done. Now, everyone did do amazing work when you did West Side, but I imagine that...
You're talking about 2016.
Right.
I'm talking about 60 years ago.
No, totally.
It's going to be 60 years next year.
Wow.
And that was another world, truly. What he got away with in his... and everybody will say, oh, but look at what he created. Look at West Side Story. Look at Gypsy. Look Mime Dancing. Look at Fiddler on the Roof. You want to name a few hundred hits.
Yeah.
You talk about Jerry Robbins. But he was brutality personified, and he did get incredible results. But can you imagine what he would have gotten having said just once, that was magnificent? Oh my goodness, the way Leonard Bernstein was the antithesis of Jerry Robbins. He took my face once in his hand. He said, oh, Carol, I never knew it could sound that beautiful. But if it doesn't feel good in your mouth, tell me and I'll change it.
Oh, wow.
Now, would you ask Leonard Bernstein to change a grace note?
No, no way.
But he was a teacher. He was a mentor. He was my mentor. He was the person who gave me the courage to suggest things, to say, can I try it like this? And he said, please be my, yes, of course. And Jerry, you had to get away. When they were ready to do the ballet in West Side Story, you know, Jerry Robbins gets tremendous credit, and for what he did, he deserves every ounce. But the fact that in West Side Story was the first time the leads sang and danced and acted. I mean, we were the leads in the ballet. In Oklahoma, Curly and Laurie are replaced by ballet dancers who were doing lifts and throws and catches and all that nonsense. Well, I've danced all my life, and on my bio, for which Mr. Robbins received one, I did 13 auditions for West Side Story. I did two other Broadway shows in the interim of the 2.5, almost 3 years it took for him to cast it.
Wow.
What was that? Can you tell us a little bit about the audition process then? I mean, 13 times is too many, but...
Jerry Robbins, I don't think anybody's ever done 13. Mm-hmm. There is a law in equity. And when they found out after the show had opened, I was doing an interview, and they said, well, how many times did you have to audition for Mr. Robbins? I said, actually, it was 13. And they said, really? And I said, well, yeah. Equity found out, and they brought me up on charges. which said, you should never have auditioned that many times. And I said, if Jerry Robbins, Leonard Bernstein, Arthur Lawrence, you know, Hal Prince, all these people want you to audition for the equivalent of Juliet in Romeo and Juliet in a modern day Shakespearean play set, you know, in an operetta, then would you not audition another time? And they said, well, not that many. I said, well, I would do it 58 times. I don't care how many times it takes him to make up his mind whether you're right. I just want to be right. When he began to rehearse, to create the ballet on the stage, I went to him because he brought on two ballet dancers from ballet theater that he had hired to do Tony and Maria. And I said, Jerry, would you allow Larry and me to learn the parts of ballet? And he said, well, you don't dance. And I said, yeah, I wanted to say, if you read any of my bios, you would have seen that I've been dancing from the time I was five.
Yeah.
But he didn't. And neither would he let me audition as a dancer. Every audition I would say, and I also dance, Mr. Robbins. And he would always say, of course you do. Next! He never, ever wanted to see if I were telling the truth.
Uh-huh.
And so he said, you do? I said, yes. He said, well, he can't, pointing to Larry. He can't even walk straight. He put Larry down every chance he got.
Wow.
I said, well, would you just let us, we'll go way in the back and learn it. And if you don't think we can cut it, you know, we don't do it. And he said, well, I don't want to see you learning. Get in the wings. Get in the wings, I don't want to see you. So we got in the wings. Well, you can't learn it sideways. So I went way upstage as far as I could, and then I came on the stage just a little, and as he saw us in the corner that we were doing it, he said, okay, Tony and Maria, because he never called you by anything but your character name. He never, ever called me Carol. Never. And, okay, Tony, Maria, get to the center, way upstage. Yeah, stay right there. We did. And then later on he said, Tony and Maria, come downstage. Come down, come down. And as soon as I got center stage, I did not relinquish it.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
And that's why we did the ballet.
Wow.
Fascinating. I'm going to go back just a tiny bit. Is it true that when you came to New York City for the first time, you went to an audition and you got the job at the first audition you ever went on in New York?
Very first, yes. And I wasn't really allowed to audition. My father told me he only came and brought us to the New York area because I had a full scholarship to Northwestern University, and I didn't want it. I said, I am 17. At 16, you peak. You know that a dancer's life goes down after 16. And up until that point, I had always planned on going to Broadway. My father wanted me to be the lawyer he could never be. And I said, please let me. He said, no, you're only 17, and you're still a minor, and I get to tell you what you can or cannot do, and you will go to Northwestern and on a full scholarship. And so I said, well, this year, instead of taking us to Yellowstone Park or wherever for the 2 weeks so that we could do extracurricular reports, you know, that he was academia personified. And I said, at least then I can see what an audition looks like and I can prepare for it. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm.
I guess he could not resist the logic of a lawyer arguing like that. We arrived at 42nd Street where there is a huge newsstand. And I bought a trade paper called Show Business. And mm-hmm. in it was an open audition, very much like All That Jazz. And it was at the Winter Garden Theater. And we were staying somewhere on 42nd Street. So I said, I'm going to go and see what this audition is like. And I went into the door, the stage door, and I said, excuse me, but is it possible for me to audit the audition? Do what? I said, you know, just watch. Can I just watch it and take some notes? And he said, either you put on your leotard and your shoes and get in line over there or get out of my face. And so I went back to the hotel and got my leotard and my shoes, and I came back. I stood in line, and, you know, it was, you do kicks, then you do turns, and as the line breaks, at each end, each wing, is somebody who says, you can stay, thank you very much, thank you, and I did all of the routines, I did the combinations, and by the end of the day, I was in a Broadway show.
What was that show, Carol?
Okay, you ready?
Yeah.
Called Borscht Capades, B-O-R-S-C-H-T, and it was a Catskills review starring Joel Grey, his father Mickey Katz and his orchestra, Phil Foster, Gene Barry, the Barry Sisters, and every Jewish comic you've ever seen in the Catskills, and me. I was in the dancing chorus, but I got to do the curtain speech with another girl. Want to hear it?
Yes.
It goes like this. Now you have to figure, because Mickey Katz was from California, he's in his white chaps. I'm in a little short suede with the fringe, a cowboy outfit with a 6-gallon hat and a wonderful boots, trying to look Californish. And it goes like this. Shalom from California, land of palms and dates, home of the Michigoyam, you'll see in borscapades. The borscht is bubbling over, hold on to your hats. Here comes that little Mazik, presenting Mickey Katz! And out he comes. And that was my first show. And we were a hit. It was a hit. We were a hit, oh yes. We played for a long time. It was wonderful. I got to do all the solos because I had long black hair, and I was Italian, so I looked Jewish, and I got to pray over the candles. I didn't know what I was doing. I got to be a little Hasidic bride. I got all the solos, and they said, the only shiksa in the group, and she's doing the solos. Why is that? They did not like it, not at all. But I got to meet Joel. We're good friends to this day. Phil Foster. You remember Phil Foster from Shirley and Laverne? Laverne?
Yeah, he was Laverne's dad on Laverne and Shirley.
That's right. And he was adorable. He was so funny.
Now, Carol, I forgot to ask you earlier. Before your name was Carol Lawrence, what was your birth name?
Okay, you got a pencil?
You got it. We're ready.
Carolina, C-A-R-O-L-I-N-A, means little Carol because I was always tiny, skinny. I never liked to eat, and I was always dancing. So it was very, very thin. Carolina Maria, which is my real middle name, Laraia, L-A-R-A-I-A. And when I was 13, and my teacher by this time said, you're a wonderful tap dancer, and you should be doing your own nightclub act, because only in front of a paying audience do you get the truth. And she's right. You know, everybody at the recital, your relatives want you to be terrific, so they're all going to say, yay, oh, that was great. And everybody in class will never tell you you're worth anything because they're competing with you. But in front, for three shows every night and four shows on Saturday, the fourth show began at 3:45 a.m. for the four drunks who didn't want to go home to their wives.
Oh, no.
And they sat, and, you know, they were mostly bombed and drunk. But you did your entire show, and then you went home as the sun came up.
Wow.
And who said you should be Carol Lawrence?
Well, Carolina is, you know, that's too funny, on a marquee and in a program. So Carol was what I was called always at school. Nobody ever called me Carolina. That was what I was called at home. And my grandmother, Carolina, vieni qua. And, you know, she that was my name, Little Carol.
Now, when you were auditioning for musicals, did you have a standard audition song that you would always use?
I did. It's called When Does This Feeling Go Away? It's from Make-A-Wish by Hugh Martin.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Does this feeling go away? Why does it remain? A lovely, sweet little ballad that nobody ever knew. I never liked to sing anything that everybody did. That was one of the trademarks. Yeah. I always wore the same pink shirtwaist to my West Side auditions, all 13, so they could remember the pink shirtwaist with the ponytail. That was me. Yeah, yeah.
Now, how did New Faces of 1952 come about for you?
Well, by that time, I had done my fabulous Borschtcapades. I was then doing commercials. I was, whatever was going around, television, you could do, if you weren't in a Broadway show, you could be in a television show. Like, I can't remember what the names of them were, but they all had dancing choruses.
Mm-hmm.
If you can remember that far back, this is the beginning of television.
I have to ask you, in New Faces of 1952, you got to work with two of our favorites, Alice Ghostly and Paul Lynn. Do you have any memories of work? Oh, we're obsessed with them. Do you have any memories of working with them?
Oh, my God, yes. We were only 17 in the entire company, so everybody understudied everybody else. And it was a very close company. Dick Barstow was the choreographer. He taught me my tap routine in a pair of gum-soled sneakers. So I kept saying, is that a shuffle? Is that a cramp roll? Of course it is. Can't you hear it? Well, not in rubber on the floor. Not really, but he and his sister, Edie, were the choreographers. And Leonard Stillman was a Christian Scientist, and so nobody could get sick. He said, just go right through it, just play right through it, and you couldn't breathe. You know, you had the flu, and you were coughing and throwing up. He'd say, you're fine, you look great, until he got sick. Then he'd say, get me an ambulance, I'm dying! And they'd say, what happened to that Christian Science nonsense you keep shoving down our throats? No, it was a wonderful company, and Paul Lynde and Alice were one person. If you know, you never saw the show, did you? You
don't. No.
Oh my God, Ronnie Graham was the writer and the narrative, and it was a review. And we opened. He said, "We're boning down to the bare minimums, and tonight we're going to have an actor reading a review." So he just came out, and he began, and as he read, of course, the cast came out, and we populated what he was saying. But when you watched Alice and Paul Lynde, it was Alice's innuendos and speech patterns that Paul Lynde imitated. It emanated with Alice, and I can tell you that now because they're both gone. But I would sit and watch them in the wings because theirs was a lesson in timing. and I would watch Bea Lilly in my bathrobe, and she would see me, and finally she got tired of it, because peripherally you can see somebody sitting in the wings. And one day she was doing her kabuki thing, where she plays the Japanese, I don't know, that terrible sounding stringed instrument that looks like a long
guitar.
And she said, "Darling, why don't you just come out here on the stage where you could see me more clearly?" And she, I said, "No, I don't have any clue." She said, "That's all right." She sat me right in front of her while I stopped sitting in the wind. Yes, she was heaven in a pair of wooden shoes. God, she was brilliant.
Oh.
Just brilliant, yes. And that's where I learned my comedy timing, was from watching the very best. Billy DeWolf and Bea Lilly. And I would watch Barbara Cook. I was in Plain and Fancy. And she was the soubrette. And she was always brilliant. I don't know where the sound that comes out of her head to this day was made in heaven.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
She's just brilliant. And the sweetest southern lady you'd ever know. And that's, I think that you truly do I learned the most playing West Side Story for 2 years. Literally, doing it exhausted, doing it sick, doing it in front of an audience that couldn't care less. You dig deeper and you find ways of making it work. And, that's what I miss so terribly in today's world. It's all gimmicks. It's all green screen. It's all, blow them up, kill them,
yeah.
And violence and horrific. There are no stories to be told. I mean, you do find them in The Room, and the ones that are really loved today, if you look at what's successful, for me,
yes.
Are the stories that touch your heart and deal with family and deal with love. And I'm going to cry in a minute, but the kind of thing that happened yesterday with the shooting,
yes.
And
yeah.
The horrific stupidity that is still reigning in today's world, we as the populace have to survive it. How can we survive it without the kind of thing that we saw last night on the Tonys? And
totally.
That says that creativity and love and truth and honesty and never stopping to seek what that is will win. Not the blowing up. Forgive me for touting. But,
No.
It breaks my heart. It breaks my heart.
Yes. And we need that. We need that art, because that's how we heal.
Exactly. And when are they going to realize it has to come back into our schools? When are they going to realize that we are literally killing ourselves? Because nobody has any compassion. Nobody has any understanding.
Yeah.
Nobody has any hope. We don't have hope. I always knew as a child from my mother encouraging me and saying, "Yes, that sounds great. Good, do that." That I could always earn a living. I could always touch people. That I was never going to starve. Nobody was ever going to oppress me, because I could somehow look to a future that held me doing what I loved doing more than anything in life, and that is performing. And we don't have that in schools anymore. We just don't.
Yeah.
So find me a platform and let me scream. because we must get back to it. Somehow we have to encourage what you do in your school to happen more widely, more universally.
Yeah.
We have to, I don't know how we get into the Muslim schools. I don't know how we teach people that it doesn't matter, but that you cannot just want to kill people because they're Christians or they're homosexuals or they're whatever they are. You can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be stopped.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be stopped.
That's right.
So,
you know, going off of that point, when you were doing West Side Story, was that important for the cast and the creatives as well, which was to have the audience change their perspective?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Jerry's mission was that what we are portraying on this stage is not acceptable. It is not allowed and we've got to stop it. That was his message. We haven't gotten to that point, but I do believe that the people, like opening night, when that curtain came down, and they had witnessed the leading man dying in my arms, and a funereal procession walking off to the strains of Somewhere, that they had seen what they had seen. The audience just looked it up in total silence. It was so scary that I thought, oh dear God, all the critics were right. We are a bomb. They don't accept it, or they don't get it, or they don't want it. And I began to cry again. And then it is, if it were a choreographed drop, they all jumped to their feet and began screaming, bravo, yes, and applauding and stamping their feet. I had never heard that combination of applause before. And it really shook us, and it went on and on and on. I think we did 17, 20 curtain calls, at the end of which Lenny came all the way backstage, and he was in the wings, and he walked over to me, and we were both sobbing, put his arms around me, and yeah, and I said, oh, Lenny, it worked. We've got him. And he said, thank God. Thank God.
Yeah.
So that was opening. That was opening night.
Wow.
And I think we touched them, and I think that the show has life together. Well, it lives today because of that score and because of what it says and because of the book. But I think that it's a universal lesson that keeps being reiterated in our high schools. You know, every young person that I've ever met says, you know, I played you. I've already done West Side Story in high school. And even in penitentiaries, I went to a juvenile delinquents penitentiary. Nuns asked me, would you come and sing for them because you did West Side? And I said, yes. And I opened the session with Officer Krupke. Well, the guards didn't like it very well, but they laughed. And they would come up to me, these little babies. These are 16, 12-year-olds who have killed, who have been in gangs, mm-hmm. and said, oh, I played Gino. I was Bernardo. No, I did Bernardo. No, you didn't do Bernardo. And they all understood it because they could do it in their high school show. Mm-hmm. And they were the right cast, the right age, the right perfection in casting. And I think that it lives on because it touches the truth. It's telling the best love story that ever lived, but it's enhanced with today's music. And that's what Hamilton does. Lynn has broken that barrier that used to exist between young people and the rap and the funk and the punk and the junk that they call music today is all in Hamilton.
Yeah.
So all we have to do is continue to reach people. But we do need the skills. We do need to be taught from a very early age that we can stand up on a stage and sing and dance and communicate the truth in the most enjoyable fashion. And mm-hmm. that's what theater is.
Carol, was your father still alive to see you perform in West Side Story?
Yes. He never approved. My father was one of those very stubborn, old-world Italians. He could never tell me that because I stayed, you know. When I came back from that audition for Borscht Capades, I said, you won't believe it was the end of the day. It was like 6 o'clock. It took all day. And I said, I'm in a show. I'm in a Broadway show. He said, oh, no, you're not. That was not our agreement. You were to go and merely observe. That was what you promised me. And I said, but I've got a little bird, and it's in my hand. It's not in the bush, and you're not going to take it out of me. I can't give up. And we argued for 3 hours. I cried. I begged.
Oh,
I could do. And finally he said to me, and he became very British whenever he had to give in, if you insist upon this folly, I didn't even know what he was talking about. If you insist upon this folly, and I came to see you and you were starving in the gutter, I would not throw a penny your way.
Oh, wow.
That's what my father said. And he never did approve of what I did. Opening night of West Side, he came to our dressing room because Cheetah and I shared the lead dressing room. And, of course, her family were there. They lived in Washington, D.C., which was where we opened. So they had seen the show, and Lola was there, and Armando, and Julio, and her mother, and all these wonderful Hispanic people are there. And we're drinking champagne because the show, you know, at least the audience loved it. We didn't know if the critics were going to. And so my mother came to the door, and she was still crying, but my mother had to do her scene. And she said, "Oh, Carol," she threw her arms around me. She said, "That was so magnificent, and the costumes and the lights." She had all the right words. By now, she really knew about the show business, because I'd done other Broadway shows. And so she said, "And the last scene where you're holding him in your arms, and he's dying, and then you went off, and I'm still crying from that," she said. "But the greatest, most exciting thing is that you came from me."
Oh, wow.
And everybody sort of went, "Oh my God." I think that's why she's still crying. And I said, "Oh, Mom, thank you very much." Now, my father walked in, and he walked directly to Cheetah. And in his best English accent, he said, "Miss Rivera, I'm Michael Luraya. I'm Carol's father. And I want to tell you, my dear, that you are by far the best performer I have ever seen in my life. And I've seen many. I've been to Broadway before. And when you're on the stage, dear, no one else exists. You might as well just forget about showing up. Because your magnificent talent reach across the footlights and touch every heart. Is this your mother? Ah, may I kiss your hand? You have given birth to one of the most talented geniuses in the world, and we are indebted to you forever and ever. God bless you. Thank you so much." And he turned to me, and I'm just standing there waiting for him to at least say, "You were all right," or "It was okay." And he took my hand in a very formal way, and he said, "Carol, it was a fine production."
Oh.
And nobody could speak. I mean, it was just dead silence. And I said, "Thanks." What are you going
to
say?
Yeah, what are you going to say? Yeah.
No, he was Italian. You have to know that he would have had to admit that he was wrong. And he couldn't do that. And he never, never told me I was okay, good, bad, or indifferent. It was a fine production.
Mm.
It's as good as it gets.
Wow. So,
After West Side Story opened and you were known as Maria, did your auditioning life change a little bit? I mean, now you're no longer a chorus girl. You're definitely never going to go back there again. And so
I'm 83. I'm 83, and I'm working on a show to be done at the El Portal right now.
Yes.
I don't think I'll ever. I might die on stage. Who knows? No, my granddaughter is here, and she said, "No, you won't." The point is, once I got out of West Side, it was, if anybody cried easily or was Latin or had that kind of, I would have a crack at it. I did A View from the Bridge, which is the movie version. It's on Broadway today, and it won.
That's
it
right.
Won all kinds of Tonys. I can't wait to go and see it. No, I literally got pigeonholed into, nobody would let me be funny. And basically, that's what I was all my life. Even when I was just a kid, I would keep my cousins entertained while everybody else was having dinner. They'd say, "Oh, go, Carol will tell you a story. Go in the living room." And I took them off their hands, you see. And I can always have fun making up a story, you know, just the gloomiest, most horrific horror thing. But as I got out of West Side, I wanted to be funny. I just wanted to have a crack at it. And
right. They
would inevitably, if they couldn't get me to do it, they'd say, "Oh, well, then get Cheetah Rivera. She looks the same." And we all had the same hairdo that Gina Lola Bridges, a sort of short bob, black hair. And And they say, oh, if you can't get Cheetah, then get Rita Moreno. She had this yeah. Latin vector. And so I wanted to break out of that trio. And I cut my hair off and dyed it red.
And
for the longest, bright red, yeah. And then I was taken for Lucille Ball. But it was okay.
But she's funny.
Terribly funny. And then Lee Goober, who was married to Barbara Walters, and had his own circuit of summer stock theaters. He had two. He had one that was in on proscenium and the other in the round. And when you would take out, like, Funny Girl, I would do 18 weeks.
Oh, wow.
In summer stock. Yeah. And those were the most incredible learning schools that ever lived, because you were playing to North and South and Florida and California, Colorado. You would do the entire United States. Mm-hmm. And he sent me Funny Girl. And I said, oh, Lee, I saw Barbara Streisand do it, and I thought it was all right. And he said, I think you'd be a wonderful Funny Girl. I said, no, I'm not. And he said, will you read it? And I read it, and I listened to the album, and then I added dance. In Private Schwartz, she tap dances. In the thing where she's learning how to dance for Mr. Keeney, the first audition, I made up a whole bunch of funny little things. When she puts on the showgirl's headdress, I would fall, instead of falling into the wings, I fell onto the stage and then couldn't get up. And I said that to Larry Fuller, who did Evita, who was the director of Evita, and I said, why don't I fall on the stage? And he said, and then just never be able to get up, you know, just keep struggling with the headdress. And he said, you think that's funny? I said, well, if they laugh, it'll be, you know, we'll keep it in. And if it isn't, then we won't. And so we did, and it was very funny. And I had to put on a full hockey belt, elbow, and knee pads because I was wrecking my joints. I was falling like a clown. And I actually did that on The Tonight Show and split my lip wide open, and Red Skelton sent me a telegram that said, I'm the clown that does the pratfalls, not you, sweet. So it was fun. That's, I guess, what happens. You break the mold by learning new skills.
That's
and
right.
Then delivering. Delivering. We broke every existing box office attendance in when I did Funny Girl. I still hold those records. Bobby and I hold the record at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion for Camelot.
Oh, that's right.
That together.
Oh, yes.
Now, how often did you appear opposite each other? You did Camelot together?
For about 14 years, yeah.
Oh, wow.
We did everything, yeah. Because the kids would travel with us, you see. And and it was a wonderful double bill, because when we got married, we were those dolls on the wedding cake. Everybody had known us from television. We met cast as husband and wife doing a wonderful two-hour special called The Enchanted Nutcracker. And the book was written by Sam and Bella Spiewak, who wrote
A Kiss Me, Kate.
Yes.
And then, and very quickly, Carol, just for our listeners, so they know who you're referring to.
Our young ones, too.
Our young ones. So you were married to Robert Goulet, who was Lancelot in Camelot for quite some time. Yeah.
Yes, of course.
Camelot, yes. Oh, he was a brilliant, brilliant singer. Perhaps the most beautiful human being I've ever met. And I kept trying to get him to dance. I kept trying to get him to act. I kept trying to bring him to, you know, just to expand. He had such a magnificent base upon which to build his talent, and he was happy singing, and he felt intimidated when dancing with me, and I guess that's okay. But
that's okay.
Yeah.
Well, talented man.
Two gorgeous sons, Christopher and Michael Goulet, who sound exactly like him and choose not to sing. You know, they've been to all the bad shows, and you know, the room service that never comes and the airplanes that never land, and they are both nurses.
Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah, they love helping people. They can sing the pants off of anybody on Broadway and choose not to. And that's their choice.
Well, Carol, I hope you'll join us again.
I would love to.
So much more to talk about. You're so fascinating and you're so wonderful. But from the bottom of our hearts, thank you so much for your generosity with us today.
Join us next week when our guest is theater historian and critic Peter Felicia.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.